You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome to the Brookings Institution and our event on what was a very exciting election and continues to be. But I'd like to underscore at the very beginning, it's exciting, but it's perfectly normal. The vote counting that is going on in states around the country is the kind of vote counting that happens in every election. If there is a difference, it's because millions more people voted by mail in this election because of the pandemic. In a couple of states like Pennsylvania, state legislatures declined to reform their laws so ballots could be prepared earlier. So it's taking longer to count the ballots in Pennsylvania than it is in other states. And the kinds of leads candidates enjoy some of the states are no closer than leads we've seen in many elections. At the moment, Joe Biden is ahead of Donald Trump by margins equal to or greater than the margins Trump won by in Michigan and Wisconsin. Biden does have a small margin in Nevada where they are still counting votes. One other fact about the election I think is worth underscoring is as of this moment, Biden either has secured or leads in states with exactly 270 electoral votes. And with the states of Pennsylvania and Georgia in particular, still very much in play. My colleague, Elaine Kmark, will tell us much more about that. But I think it's just important in this climate, especially given some of the things the president said last night, to underscore again, this is normal democracy and vote counting. I've got an awesome panel of colleagues here. By the way, my name is E.J. Dionne. I'm, as you can see on your little screen, I'm a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. I'm really honored to be joined by a group of extraordinary colleagues. I also want to thank everyone who has sent questions in advance, and we're going to try to answer a lot of those. For example, there is an excellent series of questions on youth voting and what young people did and might do after this election. Camille wants to take those on. There are other questions about the Senate and House races that Molly will take on. We are probably not going to answer the questions on what would a Joe Biden administration look like or what will they do in foreign policy, because we think it probably makes the most sense have this election finally decided, which we probably will have to wait a day or two for. The other thing I want to say is you can submit your own questions two ways, either to events@brookings.edu or on Twitter. The hashtag is #election2020, all one word. And those questions are going to filter back to me, and I'm going to try to use as many of them as I can as the event goes forward, because the smart people out there may well think of better questions than I will. So I want to thank you for your participation. So let me briefly introduce Camille Bissette, a senior fellow in governance studies with affiliated appointments in our economic studies and metropolitan studies programs. She is director of the Race, Prosperity, and Inclusion Initiative, a Brookings cross-program initiative focused on issues of equity, racial justice, and economic mobility for low-income communities and communities of color. Her work is focused on systematic racism, economic advancement of Black and Native American boys, the importance of social relationship to economic mobility, and equity in healthcare and local and state government policy priorities. You can tell she's been very busy in this period of the pandemic. Welcome, Camille. I want to introduce next in alphabetical order my colleague, John Udack, the deputy director of the Center for Effective Public Management, a senior fellow in governance studies. His research examines questions of presidential power in the context of administration, personnel, and public policy. He focuses on campaigns and elections, legislative executive intersection, and state and federal marijuana policy. This is the place to be if you want to find out where all of those, what happened in all of those marijuana referenda that were on the ballot around the country yesterday. He's just awesome on electoral politics and polling, which is one of the things he'll discuss. Alin Kmark is a senior fellow in the governance studies program, as well as director of the Center for Effective Public Management. She's an expert on American electoral politics, government innovation in reform and reform in the U.S., but also in OECD nations and developing countries. She is the author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. And she is also a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Finally, but in no means least, our dear colleague Molly Reynolds, a senior fellow in governance studies. She studies Congress, which is very useful for us today, in particular, with an emphasis on how congressional rules and procedures affect domestic policy outcomes. She is the author of the book Exceptions to the Rule, The Politics of Filibuster Limitations in the U.S. Senate, which may or may not become relevant soon. And the consequences of the budget reconciliation process and other procedures in the U.S. Senate. And she also supervises the maintenance of a wonderful Brookings, used to be book, now I think it's mostly online, that if I remember right, was started by our colleague Tom Mann and also Norm Ornstein over at the American Enterprise Institute, Vital Statistics on Congress. So let me begin by turning to Alin. I laid out the sort of very raw data on the results of this election. Tell us what's happening and what we are likely to see over the next couple of days. Unmute yourself. You're muted, Alin?
Yeah. All right. There we go. Thank you, EJ, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this Brookings webinar. This is a very, very tight race, and the count is taking a very long time, but we knew that would happen. We knew that the combination of an extraordinary number of absentee and early votes plus a very, very tight race would mean a long count. And I think as Americans, we all want this count to be as careful and as deliberate as possibly can be. Given that, we are down to a handful of states. And some, let me just talk about some of them and give you a sense of what's happening in each one. In Nevada, Biden has a very, very narrow lead. And they have announced that they're not going to count any more votes until Thursday at noon. And they'll announce them Thursday at noon. They're not making any more announcements. What is giving Democrats hope in Nevada is the fact that Clark County, which is home to Las Vegas and Reno, the two population centers of an otherwise very rural state, a lot of those ballots have not been counted yet. So Democrats are hoping that the 0.6% margin that Biden now enjoys will get bigger. In Arizona, which some networks have already called for Biden, there is a 3.4% lead by Biden. 86% of the vote is in, but Maricopa County, which is Phoenix, which is the population center of that state, and which is also very Democratic, Phoenix is still counting votes. So that could actually get bigger. Wisconsin has almost all the votes in, and there the Biden lead looks to be 0.6%, same as in Nevada, ironically. And it looks like they may be headed for an automatic recount. Trump has already stated that he wants a recount there. And given how extraordinarily close that is, that's probably fine. This election could come down to Wisconsin. And finally, in Michigan, and I'm going to talk about Michigan and Pennsylvania. Michigan, again, Biden has a very narrow lead, under 1%. 94% of the vote is in. However, in Wayne County, which is Detroit, which is a heavily Democratic vote, only 81% of the vote is in. And in Grand Rapids, another Democratic center in the state, Only 85% of the vote is in. So Biden runs a chance of exceeding that 0.9% when those counties come in. The reason I gave you those four first is that at this moment, the Biden campaign is saying they've got 270 electoral college votes, and they've got it. If they get those four states and nothing untoward happens in the other states, that they've got it. That means, interestingly enough, that they don't need to win. Biden doesn't need to win Pennsylvania, may not need to win Pennsylvania. And that may be a good thing because, frankly, Trump has a very large lead in Pennsylvania, a lot large. I mean, the polls were just way off on Pennsylvania. The polls were showing an average of a 5-point lead in Pennsylvania. Trump's lead is 8.1% right now. However, again, only 19 of Pennsylvania's 67 counties have reported their absentee ballots. If you'll remember, Pennsylvania, like Wisconsin, is one of those states where the Republican state legislature said, nope, can't count the absentee ballots before Election Day. So they just started counting on Election Day. And that's a huge, huge number of votes in Pennsylvania. Among the counties where they need to count the absentee ballots are Philadelphia and Allegheny County, which is the city of Pittsburgh. Both of those population centers are places where Biden has been leading in the polling. And if you combine the votes that are out from there, plus the fact that most of these absentee ballots we've been seeing have tended to lean Democratic, it's possible that Pennsylvania will fall into the Democratic column, but that's a stretch. So, you know, right now we are looking at an exquisitely narrow race. I mean, maybe we have a 270 to 268 result here, which is practically a tie in the Electoral College, although not a tie. And a lot of this, my final comment will be that a lot of what we saw last night and the anxiety and the drama has to do with this dramatically new way of voting. If you were a Democrat last night and you tuned in right at 7 o'clock, you were really excited because guess what? Florida was blue, North Carolina was blue, and Ohio was blue. Well, that's because they counted their absentee ballots early. So the Democratic vote came in first. What we're seeing in other states, of course, is that the states that came in where the ballots or the absentee ballots are coming later, they are red initially by big margins, and then the margins are shrinking as the absentee ballots come in. So the bad news is we're going to have to wait a couple days to really see what this picture is. The good news is that states seem to be taking their time, doing this carefully. And if you, just a reminder to everybody out there, when these votes are counted in the room, there is a representative of the Republican Party and a representative of the Democratic Party. They are watching every single count all across the country. And of course, both parties are armed with lawyers ready to go right to court if they think something untoward is happening. So there's a lot of transparency to this process. And we are just going to have to wait a couple days to see where it ends up.
Could I just ask a quick follow-up? The Biden campaign argues that, in fact, in Pennsylvania, there really are a whole lot of outstanding ballots from Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. And they are speaking, and I don't think it's put on, although we'll find out, with a fair amount of confidence that they can actually overcome this margin. And then there's also talk that a lot of ballots are missing, haven't been counted yet, not missing, just there are a lot of uncounted ballots in Fulton and DeKalb counties, i.e. Atlanta and the suburbs that are Democratic. And so Georgia still seems in play. Could you just deal with that one last sort of moving piece here?
Yeah. Georgia is already at 93% of the vote counted. Okay, so the missing ballot, and that's true that Atlanta or Fulton County and DeKalb County where Biden is strong, aren't all in. DeKalb County, Biden is winning but it's only 85% in. So there's a possibility there. I wouldn't necessarily count on Georgia, frankly, just given the history of it, given the results in the Senate races, which I know Molly will talk about. I wouldn't really put Georgia in the bank yet. Pennsylvania is a very interesting question. You know, it's a state that's got Philly and Pittsburgh, and the joke is that Pennsylvania is Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Alabama in the middle. And that big middle swath of the state is extraordinarily conservative on just all sorts of questions, including race, which is why they call it Alabama in the middle. Those counties, as I was watching last night, and I know a little bit about Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, was there on election day. Those rural counties were coming in with huge Trump margins. I mean, they were even though they're small counties, not a lot of voters, they were coming in 71, 72, 75% Trump. So there has to be an awful lot of votes in Philly and Pittsburgh to make up this 8% gap we're seeing now. And I know that the Biden campaign is, you know, enthusiastic about it and thinks they're eventually going to win Pennsylvania. But I wouldn't be as sure of that as I am, say, of Michigan.
Thank you. John Udack, you have spent a lot of time with the exit polls. And as we talked about this before, exit polls were particularly vexed this year since an awful lot of people were not there to exit a polling place because they didn't vote at a polling place. But there have been some adjustments where by combining methods, there was one produced. And John, you've take a look at it very carefully. And we would, I'm sure everybody out there would be interested in what you have found about what we all did yesterday.
Sure. Thanks.
Or what we all did actually for the last month.
Thanks, EJ. And I just want to reiterate your comments at the top that it's frustrating that we don't know whether President Trump is being reelected or whether Joe Biden has won. And that should not signal to anyone that the process isn't working. It is a signal that the process is working, that these votes are being counted. And again, while it's frustrating, the alternative of this being a sham process is much worse than frustrating. I think we should be happy the care that election officials are taking in a lot of states, really in every state, but especially in these key states over the coming days. So the exit polls told really two sort of different stories, two sort of competing stories. Particularly compared to 2016. In some ways, this was a repeat of what we saw in 2016. A lot of the demographics looked fairly similar in terms of turnout, given that exit polls, of course, also have a margin of error, you know, a 1 or 2% difference between now and 2016 really is indistinguishable. And so when you look at, for instance, women turned out, they were 53% of the electorate in 2016. They were 53% of the electorate in 2020. In 2016, Clinton won women by a margin of 13 points. In 2020, Biden won women by a margin of 13 points. There are a lot of consistencies between the 2 years. There are a couple of differences, though. So again, a couple of points here and there. It's hard to distinguish, but it suggested that the electorate was a little bit older this year than it was in 2016. In 2016, 44% of the turnout came from people under the age of 45. That number was 41% in 2020. In 2016, 50% of the electorate held a college degree. 50% did not. Last night, 56% of the electorate did not hold a college degree. And so that would suggest a sort of benefit for Trump. We all always hear about the white working class voters and the benefits that they were able to deliver to President Trump. But the Trump margin evaporated among individuals without a college degree. So in 2016, individuals without a college degree, Trump won them by 7 points. It was a tie last night. It was 49-49 for Biden and Trump. Those are some interesting numbers. It also showed that there is a a continuing trend. Our colleague Bill Fry has written about this pretty significantly. I know Camille is going to talk a little bit about this too. The electorate was less white last night than it was in 2016. In 2016, 71% of the electorate was white. Last night, that was 65%. That is a trend that we are going to continue to see. Bill Fry's work shows us just how diverse America is getting, how diverse the electorate is getting, and that has significant effects. And so that this was a close race is not surprising when we look at the exit polls, because 2016 was a close race. And if we see these differences as fairly minimal in terms of what the electorate looked like, it's not a surprise that this is going to be maybe a small win for Joe Biden, maybe a small win for Donald Trump. But just like in 2016, where President Trump won the election because of 78,000 votes spread across Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, it looks like the victor is going to come down, as Elaine said, to just a couple of states and probably razor-thin margins in a couple of those states. Now, that said, there were some pretty significant changes last night when we look at what happened. Biden, as Elaine said, some of the outlets have called Arizona for Biden. I'm pretty sure Biden is going to win Arizona. That's a historic change, a change that a lot of us saw, of us saw coming over time, but a change nonetheless. The narrowing of the Republican advantage in states like Georgia is also a trend that we're going to be looking at. Stacey Abrams' run for governor in razor-thin loss 2 years ago, I think, foretold that this was happening in Georgia. And it looks like President Trump will probably win Georgia by a hair, but Biden might, because of DeKalb County and Fulton County, might be able to eke out a win. But if you rewind 4 years ago or 8 years ago, we weren't talking about this in Georgia. We weren't having this kind of conversation with Georgia. And it does suggest that there are these changes in the electorate in some states that perhaps don't change things in 2020, but maybe they do change things in 2024, states like Texas as well. I think that's going to be a big part of the conversation. And so that the electorate didn't look all that different from 2020, I think might be an interesting story. But I also think that we are looking at a razor thin election fits pretty neatly in with President Trump's political strategy over his 4 years in office so far and during his campaign. And that was not to expand his opportunities, not to try doing new things or appealing to different voters in different ways. It was a very pure base campaign to connect with the people who voted for him in 2016, which if you're Barack Obama in 2008 and you try to do in 2012, rather, and try to connect with your voters from 2008, that's a hell of a lot of voters to connect to. And you have a very comfortable margin. But when you've won by such a narrow margin, not trying to expand your appeal means one of two things is going to happen. You're either going to lose or you're going to win by a razor thin margin. And I think that's where we're at right now. America's deeply divided. And I think the campaigns that were run ended up appealing to a lot of the same voters who each campaign won in 2016.
Could I just point out one thing, which is Joe Biden at the moment, as of this very moment, has 69,941,000 votes. He's easily going to tip over into 70 million. Joe Biden will get more votes than any presidential candidate in our history. His popular vote margin, you're quite right, John, about razor thin in a number of states. His popular vote margin is nationally over 2 points. Right now, it's 3 million votes. And given how many votes are out in California and urban areas, it's very likely that Joe Biden's popular vote margin will be up around 5 or 6 million by the time this is all over, maybe more. And I just obviously, those of us who are interested in reforming the Electoral College can't resist noting that. But I also think it's important optic for to see the election in and not simply focus on razor thin margins in the states. Would you dissent from that in any way?
No, I agree. And I think the conversation in the National Popular Vote campaign and in other organizations that are looking to get rid of the Electoral College this is going to be one more example of why that reform would drastically change electoral politics in the United States. And it's also important to note, there's a lot we don't know about how this race is going to turn out. But you're right, EJ, we do know that Joe Biden will win the popular vote. That is a certainty at this point. And so that means since 1992, Republicans have won the popular vote in the United States once in 2004. And I was talking to Elaine last week, and I said, what that means is we are going to have voters voting on Election Day in 2024 who have not been alive during a time when Republicans won the popular vote in the United States. 18 and 19 year olds will have been born in 2005 and 2006. And that's a fairly remarkable situation in electoral politics, particularly when you rewind back from 1992 and you look at significant popular vote wins during the Bush and Reagan years. That is a drastic transformation in our politics.
Thank you very much. Camille wanted to take on a number of questions, including, by the way, some of the very questions that came in before the event from many of our thoughtful participants. I'll read a couple of those and then go to the other issues you want to take on. Is there any indication that new and first-time voters will remain active beyond this election or the election? Will the younger voters begin to have more political voice and power? How are young people being given a voice outside the general election? How can we empower our youth to be a voice? And Camille, there was real racial polarization in this election. There were important developments in the Latino vote. We were talking before about looking at how different the Latino vote was in, for example, Maricopa County, Arizona, and Miami-Dade County in Florida. Please take on this whole panoply of questions, including the ones from our thoughtful viewers. I'm just asking you to deal with everything.
Okay, well, great. No worries there. like my colleagues before that, I will do my best. But first of all, I just want to welcome everybody. Thank you for joining us. And thanks, EJ, for teeing up the area that I'm going to deal with. I just want to start by saying that this morning, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, which is a large paper in southern Germany, started off by saying that American democracy is kaput. And I just want to join my colleagues in saying what we've seen here last night and over the last month has been an extraordinary exercise in democracy. And I think in many, many ways, makes it very clear that democracy in the US is pretty healthy. The care, the caution with which votes are now being counted, I think also, again, underscores the health of our democracy. So I think it's we're actually in a really good place from a perspective of having a really well functioning democracy and having incredible turnout. So kudos to all my fellow Americans for really participating. What I wanted to talk about in my segment really was some of these different ethnic voting blocs, and I wanted to start by saying that what I thought I saw in the exit polls and also in the votes as they're being counted is that there were actually two countervailing trends here that probably explain some of what we're seeing and how tight these margins are in particular states. So the first is, as John had mentioned, the demographics in the United States are clearly shifting. You have a smaller percentage of the voting public is white, and a larger percentage are people of color. And that is kind of an inescapable sort of direction in which we're moving. And the other sort of trend or countervailing kind of a pattern I saw is that there was really a lot about race and racism in this particular election. And I think those are actually a little bit, those two trends, I think, can help explain some of the differences that we saw and the tightness of these elections. So let me talk about that a little bit. I want to talk about, first of all, Latino votes, right? And we always think about the Latino vote, and I want us to be pretty cautious about saying that as we move forward. There are so many different Latino constituencies with very different histories of insertion in the U.S. And different sort of cultural references, et cetera, different racial identities. So I think it's really, we use it as a shorthand, but I think it's really important, particularly as you look through some of these electoral results to really differentiate between the different kinds of Latino votes. I'm going to do that here. Using as an example, Maricopa County in Arizona and Miami-Dade in Florida. So in Maricopa County, you have an increasingly large Latino electorate. Most of those folks their heritage is Mexican, largely Mexican. So they may be several generations away from Mexico, or they may be very recently arrived. But that is largely a Mexican American constituency. Within that constituency, what we saw is that a lot of young people got really, really activated in Maricopa County. A lot of young Latinos got very, very activated there. And that pattern actually started in the 2018 cycle. The Democratic Party put some resources into young Latino voters in Maricopa County, and that has paid off pretty handsomely. So what you see when you look at the issue areas that Latinos voted on in Maricopa County, they were primarily concerned with COVID, the economy, and jobs. Those are the things that they were most concerned with. If you now move over to Miami-Dade, where Biden really underperformed Hillary Clinton. So Hillary Clinton did pretty well in Miami-Dade, particularly among Latinos in 2016. That is not true for Biden. Biden still carried Miami-Dade, but it was really, really much thinner margin than Hillary Clinton had enjoyed. And the reason for that actually is a depression in the Latino vote for Biden. So what does that Latino vote for Biden look like in Miami-Dade? Well, that is primarily, the Cuban American base. And Cuban Americans historically have been much more Republican, but I think what really emerged in this election is that Cuban Americans have a very organized machine in Miami-Dade. They hold a lot of electoral offices. They have a lot of resources for pulling out the vote. And in terms of issue areas, the key issue areas for them, among the top three issue areas, were the economy and violent crime. So when you think about, you hear the term violent crime, you're talking about this whole set of issues around law and order, which is really code for, making sure that people of color continue to be supervised, let me put it that way, by law enforcement entities. And so what's interesting about the Cuban American vote is that it's mostly white. So Cuban Americans, particularly who have a history of having come over here pre-Castro or immediately post-Castro, were from the elite in Cuba. Cuba has a lot of Black Cubans, but those Black Cubans mostly stayed in Cuba. So the people we have here are people who are they're sort of re-emphasizing that kind of racial split that you had in Cuba that allowed them to do well in Cuba, allowed them to come over here and make new lives for themselves. And so when Trump talked about law and order, that actually had a lot of resonance for Cuban Americans who largely here are white and do not see themselves as having anything in common with other Latinos, particularly Latinos who have, have African heritage or some part of their heritage is African. So those are very distinct votes. The Mexican American vote in Maricopa County, which is not, which when we talk about racial issues, actually is much more concerned with how different types of people are treated in the U.S. That turned out to be an important issue for them as well. But when we come back to Miami-Dade, we're talking about Cuban Americans, particularly white Cuban Americans, which make up 97% of the Latino vote in Miami-Dade. you were talking about racial politics. So there, I think, you know, there's racial politics and then there's demographics. And I think those two combine to give some pretty interesting results in Latino communities. I also want to talk a little bit about Black voters. So there was a lot of chatter before the election about how Trump was trying to pick off Black men. And we had a number of, you know, rappers and other kinds of personalities, sports figures coming out to say, you know, that they endorsed Trump. It turns out when you look at exit polls and other kinds of polls that Black men actually went for Trump at 82% of Black men went for Trump and for Black
women.
Wait,
82% went for Trump?
No, sorry, for Biden. Sorry.
Yeah,
I misspoke. 82% went for Biden. Thank you for correcting me. 82% went for Biden and 91% of Black women went for Biden. So, you know, there's that narrative around Trump really peeling off Black men. It turns out that didn't actually happen. And so Blacks pretty much went for Biden. And that's, you see that throughout a variety of different polls and results. The last thing I want to talk about is young people. So this is an election where we had a very, very, very strong turnout from people who were in that sort of 18 to 30 age range. And part of that is people were galvanized by the racial justice politics. Part of it is people were galvanized by some of the economic issues that were coming out. But we saw a lot of really good participation from young people. And now the question is, how do each of these parties, both Democrats and Republicans, continue to energize young people as we move forward? And I would, you know, I'd venture to say that actually for the Republicans, it's going to be a little bit more of a taller order for them because they haven't actually reached out in quite the same way that Democrats have in activating, particularly around, you know, Black Lives Matter and other kinds of social justice issues. So that remains to be very, to be seen. But I think that's a very interesting component of where the vote was this time and what it portends for 2024.
Thank you for handling so many questions for us. I just want to, on the Cuban Americans in particular, if anyone wondered why did Donald Trump keep saying that Joe Biden was going to be a secret socialist, that was also a clear appeal to a community that had escaped a communist regime. And I think that
absolutely
may have had some impact among conservative Latinos from various who have immigrated from various places, although I'm not sure it did not seem to have that same power with Mexican Americans, although there's evidence that South Texas also did not turn out for Biden the way they had hoped. But so I think we're going to be talking about the Latino vote a lot in the next 4 years. But thank you for that. Molly, you know everything about Congress. So what happened? It appears that the Republicans are going to hold on to the Senate, although maybe we'll have some runoffs in Georgia. Tell us what happened on Tuesday and why and what it portends for governing.
Sure. Thanks, EJ. I certainly don't know everything about Congress, but I have some thoughts on what happened yesterday, what's likely to happen in the next couple of weeks and going into 2021. So I thought I'd start by talking about the House, then talk a little bit about the Senate. So I think it's safe to say that what we saw yesterday, and as the results continue to be tabulated, as my colleagues have indicated, just as the continuing tabulation of results in the presidential race is completely normal. The continued tabulation of results in congressional races is also completely normal. I'd point folks back to 2018 when in California, for example, it took several weeks before a number of House races were finalized. So this kind of slow, methodical tabulating of ballots, again, is what it is not unusual for congressional races either. But having said that, we did see an unexpectedly weak performance for House Democrats yesterday. Going into Election Day, the kind of rhetoric that you were hearing was that a bad night for House Democrats would be if they only picked up 5 seats and that there was expectation they would pick up, say, 10 or 15. And at the moment, it looks like they stand to actually lose some seats. And several of these losses were in districts.
Did you say lose some seats? Did you put a number? Did you put a number?
I did not put a number on it at this point, because the situation is that they'll still hold the majority, but the situation is fluid enough that I don't want to assign a specific number to it yet. But what I will say is that they also Democrats also have picked up at least two seats in North Carolina, which are related to redrawing of North Carolina's district lines. So we'll see where things land eventually. But several of the seats that Democrats did lose in the election in the House are held by freshmen who had picked up those seats in 2018. So I want to talk about that group of folks for a second. So in 2018, there were 41 seats that flipped from being controlled by Republicans to being controlled by Democrats. Of those 41 seats, where we are right now is that 19 of those races, the Democrat was reelected. In six of them, the Democrat has lost. And then in nine, the Democrat is trailing, and in seven, the Democrat is leading. So kind of wherever we land, this is going to be a little bit of a mixed bag. We'll need to see more of what happened with the presidential vote in each of these districts to have, I think, a much clearer sense on what I'm about to say. But one thing I will be watching is that it's entirely possible that what we're seeing in these races is the continued decline of ticket splitting. So when we look at kind of the history of congressional elections in the post-war era in the United States, the number of voters who go to the polls and vote for a House candidate of one party and a presidential candidate of the other party has declined and continues to be at very low levels. There are two Democratic losses in South Florida, for example, that I think reflect this trend when Camille was talking before about Trump's strength in South Florida. So the idea or sort of what I'll be watching to see if the data bears this out is the notion that lots of voters went to the polls yesterday, voted for Donald Trump, and then voted for a Republican congressional candidate in districts that that Democrats had picked up in 2018. And I think as we learn again more about the electorate in the 2020 election, one important trend that I'll be looking for in these House races is whether this dynamic of Democrats having picked up seats in the midterms and then having lost them in the presidential year is a consequence of the increasing education polarization between the two parties. So one thing that we've seen over the past decade plus was true. It was kind of moving before Trump, has continued moving under Trump, is the movement of white voters with college degrees towards the Democratic Party and white voters without college degrees away from the Democratic Party and towards the Republican Party. And that's a shift. We historically better educated voters were more likely to vote for Republican and simply to turn out to vote. So, and we know that presidential years turn out more voters than midterm years. So when you kind of put all these pieces together, one possible story, again, like we'll have to wait for the data to know whether this is a big driver of what we saw, but is the idea that as Democrats have become a party that has more high education, more college educated voters, those folks are more likely to turn out all the time. And then Republican voters, the Republican Party has more voters who are white voters without college degrees who are less likely to turn out all the time and thus maybe only drawn out in presidential years, that could be producing some of the dynamic where Democrats fared well in the 2018 midterms because they turned out these high education voters who voted for Democratic congressional candidates. And then in some of the same districts when there were more voters without college degrees, they were more likely to vote for the Republican candidate and for Trump. So we'll have to watch, analyze the data, but that's one possibility that helps contextualize what we saw in the House. The other thing I'll say that is interesting to watch now and when the new Congress actually begins in January is that of the Republicans who picked up seats from Democrats, we actually, a large number of these candidates are women, they are minorities, and they are veterans. So as we think about the future of the Republican Party, either four more years with President Trump, depending on how the presidential race shakes out, or after Trump, this notion that we are actually, at least in the House Republican Conference, seeing some interesting diversity is important to keep watching. On the Senate, my point about ticket splitting, I think, also holds for what we've seen in the Senate. And so there are some states that where Democrats, I think, thought the Senate seats might have been winnable, but that were in states that Trump was polling well in, was perhaps likely to win, where it was going to be really difficult to break that linkage between the presidential vote and the Senate vote. So here I'm thinking of places like Iowa, of Montana, quite possibly North Carolina, depending on how things get finalized there. And in Senate races, similarly, we see this really strong movement away from ticket splitting. The one kind of glaring exception to all of this, which I think importantly maybe helps prove the rule, is Susan Collins in Maine, where she stands to be, at least certainly so far this year, the only a state where a Senate candidate of one party, a Senate race was won by a candidate of one party, where the state's electoral votes, in Maine's case, three of its four, went for a presidential candidate of the other party. And I think what this reflects, and there's some other data that I'll mention in a moment, is that to the extent that we do still see some ticket splitting, again, at much lower levels than historically, it is often in kind of anticipation of wanting to provide a check on a president of the other party. And it happens when voters are quite sure that the president of the other party is going to win. So there's a political scientist named Bob Erickson who refers to this as anticipatory balancing. So the idea, and there's evidence to support this for presidential elections in the 20th century, post-war elections through 2012, which is that basically when voters, particularly high information voters who pay a lot of attention to politics, think that a Democratic president is going to win the White House, they ticket split more down ballot because they want to provide a Republican check in Congress on that Democratic president. And I think that could help explain what we saw in Maine. I think it also helps explain, so in Colorado, for example, while Colorado was won pretty handily by both Biden and by John Hickenlooper in a pickup for Democrats, Biden ran ahead, or at least presently is running ahead of Hickenlooper. Biden also ran ahead of MJ Hagar, the Democratic Senate candidate in Texas. So the idea that there are some people in Texas who went to the polls, voted for Biden, and then probably also voted for John Cornyn. As we look at what's happening in Michigan, I think we could see Biden perform better than Gary Peters, the Democratic senator there. So this idea that to the extent that we are seeing some divergence between the presidential race and some Senate races, not so much in the outcomes, but in the margins, that it may be because, again, some of these voters, particularly politically engaged voters, are looking at the situation, looking at their expectations of a Biden victory and saying, I'm going to vote for Biden, but I'm also going to vote for a Republican down ballot to write a check on that in the White House. So I'm just going to say briefly. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to talk a little bit about...
I just wanted to ask... Yeah, go ahead. You continue. I was going to simply ask the question, could it have just been that there were Republicans out there who just didn't like President Trump?
So that's certainly possible as well.
And then went back to their party. In other words, that they weren't making a calculation. They just would normally vote Republican, but just couldn't vote for Trump.
So that's possible. I mean, I'll remind us all of something that I said a lot after the 2016 election, which, and I expect that this will be borne out in this election as well, that most of what happened in 2016 is that Republicans voted for Trump because he was the Republican nominee, and Democrats voted for Clinton because she was the Democratic nominee. And again, I expect that to, when we get data on kind of
93% of Republicans in the exit poll voted for Donald Trump. Exactly. Yeah.
So I think that's most of it. But again, that lots of the extent we still see some ticket splitting, different explanations. But I do think in some of these key races, the kind of wide expectation of a Biden victory may have filtered down and led some voters to split their tickets. The last thing that I'll say is kind of what happened. It's hard to say, but a couple things to keep an eye on. So EJ did mention that at least one of Georgia's Senate races looks to be headed for a runoff, which will happen the first week in January. That is the a runoff for the special election in Georgia, and that'll be between Kelly Loeffler, who is currently appointed to hold that seat, and Raphael Warnock, a Democrat, who is a pastor of a prominent African-American church in Atlanta. So that is headed for the runoff. Depending on how the final vote count shakes out there, it is possible that Georgia's other Senate race between David Perdue and John Ossoff could also go to a runoff. Perdue, last I checked before we started, is still above the 50% mark. But I think that the Democrats' chances for getting to a 50-50 tie in the Senate, if Biden does win the presidential race, are increasingly narrowing. There's still a path, but it's much harder to see than it was 24 hours ago. And so what would that mean? Kind of a narrow Republican majority in the Senate, a Democratic majority in the House, and a Democratic president in the White House. I think it's not necessarily a recipe for, certainly for robust legislating on the agenda on which Joe Biden ran. It's hard to sort of map out exactly what things they would take up. I think a solid indicator early on of how that relationship between a narrow Republican majority in the Senate and Joe Biden in the White House would proceed will be to see how a Republican-controlled Senate handles Biden's prospective President Biden's cabinet nominees. Do they confirm them? Do they simply not bring some of them to the floor? What does that all look like? That's something I'll be watching closely if that is what comes to pass in 2021. And then in the House, you've started to see some sort of reporting on whether there's going to be disarray or arguments within the House Democratic Caucus about the fact that folks went into the election with a set of expectations that were not met. You've even seen some questions about whether someone will challenge Nancy Pelosi for speaker. My take on that is that if you can identify a credible alternative, then we can start to talk about whether she would be vulnerable to a challenge. I don't know who that would be at this point. The kind of conversation around House Democratic leadership elections will unfold over the next couple of weeks. So just sort of pay attention to that and kind of where the House Democratic Caucus kind of lands and where it finds itself. And some of that I think will be affected by how some of these races that are still haven't been called yet shake out. And just, you know, are there some of those folks who end up winning in a way that kind of tamps down a little bit of internal unrest if it's there in the House Democratic caucus. But I'll be paying attention to this and we'll see where things go. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Just two pieces of news. The AP and I guess the New York Times has called Wisconsin for Biden. So that's another pickup if it holds, but it's very close there. Second, just looking at the numbers on the second runoff in Georgia, Senator Perdue is at 50.6%, which means that if there actually are a lot of missing votes from DeKalb and Fulton counties, that he might just be pushed slightly under. So you, political judge.
The idea that there are votes remaining to be counted. I don't like to call them missing because we know where they are.
Yes, thank you very much. I meant them that. Entirely.
And I
was trying to be innocent about my missing. No, yes, uncounted votes. Thank you very much for that.
But yes, they could, depending on how they would break, that would be what would lead Purdue to fall under that 50% mark. But we'll just have to see what happens.
Armageddon in Georgia would be really an amazing January.
I would remind all of us that there would be a very strong sense of deja vu, because that is how we began 2017, which is with a special election in suburban Atlanta featuring John Ossoff.
Yeah. Here's what I'd like to do. I want to toss a bunch of questions out and have each of you decide this almost Hayekian of me, which is odd since I'm not a Hayekian, but leaving people free to pick the questions they want. Because I would like Elaine to talk a bit about what it would be like without Donald Trump. Is there a chance of the Republican Party changing? How would that change the nature of things? I would like Camille. I'd like John Udack to talk about the referenda, and perhaps Camille and John to talk about how bad were the polls. Or were they as bad, or did people simply read them the way they wanted to read them more than what the polls actually said? There were questions about how a recount would work. There are questions about here's one we can answer. There was a question about the Obama-Trump voters and where they went. I don't think we know that entirely yet. But and then what happens with the electors? If you get 270 electors for Biden, you could have just a wild time in the Electoral College for the first time. That was one question. Lastly, somebody asked, would the gap between Trump and Biden be bigger or smaller than the gap with Clinton? I think it will be bigger based on what we know right now, because Biden has already hit roughly the gap that Clinton was at, and it looks like it's going to grow. So that's the one question I'll answer. Camille, do you want to start picking on any of those or taking it where you wanted to briefly? And then I want to just go around the horn. We got about 14 minutes. And one last thing, if anybody wants to toss a question in before we close, it is events@brookings.edu or Twitter at #election2020. Let me start with Camille. I'll go on my screen. Camille, John, Elaine, and Molly.
Well, this is great. Thanks, EJ. And we've gotten some really fantastic questions, so I think this is going to be a lot of fun. I'm just going to answer. There was a really quick question about the mention about the Venezuelan vote in Miami. Any significant impact? I would say no. Primarily, your main Latino voting blocks in the Miami/Florida area are Cuban Americans and Puerto Ricans. Those are the big ones. Venezuelans are, they're there, but they're not as significant. So if you're talking about courting Latino votes in Florida and in Miami, you are talking about Puerto Ricans and Cubans. But Cubans there's a far greater number of Cubans in Miami-Dade than Puerto Ricans. Puerto Ricans tend to concentrate mostly in Central Florida. I want to talk about polls, and I hope John will unmute so we can do this together. But my sense of the polls is, polls always tighten up, right, a little bit. There's always a margin of error. So you expect some tightening. I think this may be, very similar to what we saw last time. To me, one of the big differences is, I think that it's hard for pollsters to get an accurate read on how people face racial issues. And if I had to pinpoint sort of one issue that I think people were a little bit less than honest about, I would say it's, this national conversation around race. And I do think that national conversation around race brought out a lot of people who were going to vote for Trump, but didn't say it because they weren't necessarily galvanized on the issue of the economy or the issue of coronavirus. So that's my take, but John, you probably have a lot more to say on that.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Camille. It's a galvanizing issue. We've known for decades what happens when pollsters ask voters or prospective voters issues that are specifically about race or deal with race, the race of a candidate, et cetera. And that can create some real complications. In terms of, you know, we've all heard the question and we're going to get asked it a million more times. Why were the polls so wrong? I'll push back a bit on that. I think the national poll is probably, the national polling average is probably going to be, within the margin of error of where this ends up being, which is probably Biden winning the popular vote by, 3-4%. The average of polls leading up to the election was, 5-6% for Biden around there. I think they performed well. Again, at the state level, most of these swing state polls were within the margin of error. Now, they were all, with the exception of Ohio and Florida, they were all breaking toward Biden. But most of them were 1-5% margins. And so it's important to note that margins of error are a real thing. And we need to recognize that when we're looking at polls. Polling isn't a lost cause. They were really performing well in 2018. This year, I think if we take a breath, wait for the results to come in and take a look, it's going to tell us that they were generally fairly accurate within a margin of error. But I will say this. What happened in 2016 was that the polls were largely breaking toward Clinton within the margin of error, and Trump did better than all of them. It was sort of on Trump's side of the margin of error. The same seemed to be happening in a lot of places this year, Trump overperforming the polls. So it raises the question, what is it when Donald Trump is on the ballot that underestimates support for him? And it's a serious question at the national level. It's a serious question at the state level. It's not a problem with polling per se. It's not a problem with the science of polling. It's, I think, a problem around how we are able to build likely voter models when Donald Trump is on the ticket. And I think pollsters, like after every election, are going to go back and take a look and see what they did right and see what they did wrong. But there is this Trump effect that I think is confounding, and it's going to inform pollsters moving forward, not just about how to deal with the person who's on the top of the ticket, but to deal with the voters who are supporting that person.
Could I just say one quick thing on that? That it struck me that the states where the polls were very close going in, like Florida, did not go to Biden, and that was not a given that he was going to carry Florida. The states where he had a bigger lead, which would be the Midwestern states plus Pennsylvania
and
Arizona and Nevada, seemed to have gone to Biden, though not by the margins anticipated. Is that fair?
But I think that in that entirety is consistent with this break toward Trump, right? So something is happening in the polls in places like Wisconsin, in places like Arizona, Michigan. That lead for Biden was much more comfortable. In most cases, still within the margin of error, but much more comfortable. And that break toward Trump just wasn't big enough to pull Biden down. But it could have been, right? I mean, we could be talking, give or take another 100,000 votes here or there, we could be talking about a significant Trump victory too. And so something is happening systematically within polls when it comes to Trump being on the ticket.
Elaine, do you want to take any of these, including the Electoral College, the litigation we're likely to see some people wanted to ask about, how would a recount work? Anything in that bucket, Elaine, is yours.
Okay. Well, there are. Let's take the straightforward ones first. The procedures for recounts are well established in state law in all states. So they're not going to make this up as they go along. There will probably be a recount, it looks like, in Wisconsin, and that will take some time, but it will be done in a timely manner. As for the Electoral College, states generally have statutes, and the statutes say that the certified winner of the state is the one whose electors get to go to the state capitol and sign what's called, in a very old-fashioned term, the certificate of ascertainment, which gets sent to the Senate. So there is a there are state laws that govern the electors, and they've been litigated over the years. There's been court cases on this, et cetera. The notion that I think has been around, either paranoid by Democrats or trying to cause trouble by others, is the notion that the a state legislature can just willy-nilly switch the electors. It's a little bit hard to do because there are many state statutes that govern it. But let me go to one of the early things you mentioned, DJ, which is the future of the Republicans and what does the world look like without Trump? Assuming that Joe Biden gets his 270 electoral votes, maybe more, by the time the week is over. And I would assume, I think we're going to know by the time the week is over with some certainty. What does it look like? Well, the depressing thing about these election results was just how big and how wide the gap is in this country between the Trump voters and the Democrats. But on the flip side of that is, if you think about the last 4 years, the single person who has most contributed to polarization is the president himself. And so many things that he said, the calling his opponents names, the lies, the racist dog whistles, all these things he has exacerbated divisions that already were in America. But we never had a president exacerbating those, right? We had presidents who tried to speak to everybody, whether they were Democrats or Republicans. So we've had a very, very unique president. If Trump is defeated, if he leaves office, which I think he will, if he's defeated, I think that we will see a lessening of this polarization for one simple fact. The president of the United States will not be fanning the flames. And I feel sort of sorry for the press, because for the press for the last 4 years has been in this bind. They know that many of the things Trump has been saying don't make sense, are outright untruths, whatever. And yet he is the president. They have to follow him. That is not the case for Donald Trump, private citizen. And there doesn't look, while there are people in the Republican Party who share the president's philosophy, I don't see anybody up and coming behind him who are likely to be as talented, shall we say, at stirring the pot as only Donald Trump can be. So I'm, EJ, like you, I'm sort of an optimist rather than a pessimist. And I actually see that even though the divisions in this election are deep, I think the removal of Trump from the scene will actually help to smooth over some of those divisions.
Thank you. I'm, you know what, funny, I'm an optimist like you are. On that one, I am struck by something a conservative friend told me a couple of days ago, which is every Republican politician will be aware that the vast majority of the party voted for Donald Trump. And so even though he is someone who would like to reform the party, he is not as optimistic that there will be a quick pull away from Trumpism. But I think there's no question that not having a period of what I like to call glorious tranquility would make a difference here. And it's on that, by the way, someone asked, how did independents vote? According to the exit poll, people who checked the independent or something else box voted 54-40 for Biden.
And DJ, I have just one thing to follow up on Elaine's point about.
Please do. That's where I was going to push you anyway.
Republicans after Trump. So I think that one thing to keep in mind, if Trump does lose and we are thinking about what governing with a Democratic president, a smaller Democratic majority in the House, and the current Republican majority in the Senate, is that a non-trivial number of the Republicans in the Senate would like themselves to run for president in 2024. And so again, if frankly, either if Trump wins or loses. And so the what that means for how they conduct themselves within the conference, I think, is important. When it looked more like Democrats would take a majority in the Senate, I had been saying that this was going to take the form of a sort of very strident return to anti-deficit and debt politics, and we can't spend money, we can't spend more on COVID relief, so on and so forth. I think there's still a possibility of that going forward, that we'll see some of these folks. But to the point you just made, EJ, about Republicans knowing that the people who elected Donald Trump also elected them is really, I think, going to be affecting how some of these, how kind of the Tom Cottons and the Josh Hawleys of the world who would like to run for president conduct themselves in the Republican the conference in the Senate.
Yeah, in fact, depending on the outcome of this election, if there is a post-Trump Republican debate, I'm hoping we can all reconvene and just with some friends on the right to discuss the many possible philosophical factions that we might see in that party. And I'm grateful for your description of the United States Senate. In some ways, the definition of a senator is someone who thinks that he or she would make a better president than all the other people they work with every day. It's amazing how many would-be presidents are in that group. Let me just, Camille has to run off to a meeting, so if it makes it easier, I want to give you a chance to jump in if there's anything that's inspired you to comment before you go. I want to answer a question and just see if anyone has closing comments. Do you have a last thought to share with us?
I don't have a last thought, except that I'm very, very hopeful that however the election turns out, everyone will have learned a very important civics lesson that hopefully will stick with us as we go through, 2024 and beyond.
Bless you for that. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I want to answer very quickly, and Godspeed. I wanted to answer very quickly a question. Has anybody, has a recount ever flipped results? Very rarely. This is a pretty big margin. I guess my worry about this recount is that the Trump campaign won't simply try to recount the ballots. They may go in to try to challenge the legitimacy of a lot of ballots. If they go down that road, we will be in for a real mess. I hope they don't go there. But there's no sense that they wouldn't. I just want to ask all three of you, we need to shut down. Something that you think we will take away or that you're going to likely think about 5 years from now about this election, just a principal takeaway. Besides, by the way, passing marijuana in four states, which we never got to, passing the minimum wage in Florida, even as it was going for Donald Trump, as John mentioned before we started, we never got there. Just each of you, a quick takeaway before we go.
I'll start with that, EJ. I was really struck, as I was 4 years ago, but this time again, at the enormity of the urban-rural divide in this country. I mean, as those counties were coming in and we were watching Florida and Pennsylvania and Michigan so carefully, there's a big difference in the worldview between urban and rural. And, if Biden becomes the president, he is certainly running. He certainly ran as a uniter. I'm hoping that he will be able to kind of begin to bridge that gap. It's a disturbing difference. And it's backed up by some hostility, a lot of misunderstanding. And I think that that's something we really need to work on.
Thank you.
I'll go quickly, EJ. I'll do both a takeaway, but also very quickly. Barack Obama said we're not a red America or a blue America. We're the United States of America. I think last night showed us we're not a red America or a blue America. We're a green America. The marijuana legalization ballot initiatives were in five states, four for adult use and one for medical, in five of the most divergent states you could imagine: Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, South Dakota, and Mississippi. They passed overwhelmingly in each of those states. And the people who are working on those campaigns put in a lot of hard work over the past several months and really years, and found remarkable success in all corners of the United States. And I think it shows some unity in this country around an issue. And there's a lot of unity around sets of issues in this country that I think a close presidential race like this often glosses over. That we might be divided about the president, but on specific issues, we can, you know, hold hands, play nice, and come together. That said, the sort of takeaway for me last night and what we might be talking about in 5 years, I've heard from a lot of Democratic friends over the past weeks and months that they saw the 2016 election as America making a mistake. But America didn't make a mistake in 2016. It felt like it didn't make one last night. It looked at Donald Trump after 4 years in office, and 66 million Americans went back to the polls and said, yes, I would like him to continue to be our president. What motivates individuals to vote for Donald Trump is something fundamental in our politics. It is not something that in our politics people are willing to say was a mistake or believe was a mistake. There are tens of millions of Americans who are happy to sign up for the types of policies and leadership that Donald Trump exhibits. And I think Democrats who write that off as a fluke do so at their own peril.
Yeah, I think that's a good segue into what my biggest takeaway is, which is just frankly how stable this race was the whole time. That if you look at kind of the approval ratings of both candidates, of the vote intention for both candidates, they're given all of the things that have happened since the beginning of 2020, we were in January, and we are in the middle of a global pandemic, and we impeached the president in that time, and we are basically where we were at the beginning. And so to John's point is that the current moment, for all of its kind of day-to-day chaos, has a lot of partisan stability of voters into two increasingly well-sorted partisan teams. And that's where we are. And as we think about where we're going, I think we should keep that in mind.
Thank you so much. I want to thank the absent Camille. I want to thank Elaine and John and Molly. And that's a really powerful point to end on, Molly. If you look at the polling averages, Joe Biden was ahead of Donald Trump in September of 2019 by a few points. And he ended up on Election Day in November of 2020 ahead of Donald Trump by a few points. And so I don't know what that tells us about the campaign and its effect. I don't even know what that tells us about COVID and its effect. It may tell you that people had made up their mind on Donald Trump a long time ago. Thank you all so much. Thank you, everyone out there, for listening. And please join us again, because we're going to be exploring the next term of the first term of the new president, or what happens if things go the other way for some time to come. And we're also going to be exploring election reform and a lot of other issues at Brookings. Thank you so much for being with us.